Welcome to the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host this week, Jay Barrett. Today we look at invasive species, those critters, large and small, that endanger the natural beauty and, in some cases, our way of life here on the Kenai Peninsula. Joining me are John Morton, the supervisory biologist at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, Jennifer Hester of the Kenai Watershed Forum's Adopt a Stream program, and Rob Massengill, a fisheries biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We begin the conversation discussing invasive northern pike, a sport fish introduced to the Kenai Peninsula and whose eradication has taken decades. Almost 20 years ago, I think I did my first story about invasive pike.
No kidding.
Yeah, huh. When I worked here before I moved to Kodiak.
And you're then ahead of your time.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was the first, I don't know if it was the first or not, but I remember somebody, talking about, there's all these invasive pike down here, and people have been stocking them in the lakes, and they're eating all the resident fish. And how have things been going, I guess?
Sure. Yeah, it's, pike have been present here on the Kenai since at least the mid-70s. Didn't garner a lot of attention till about the year 2000, when the department started taking a serious look at the pike issue here on the Kenai. And the invasion here on the Kenai, it looks like it started in Soldotna Creek. And fast forward to now, we've identified 24 different water bodies on the Kenai Peninsula that have invasive pike populations. But we've been working to get rid of them, and I'll probably talk about the reasons why a little bit later. But right now, we have only 8 of those waters that still have pike that we're aware of. So we're making some headway.
Oh, okay. I thought they were all taken care of. Didn't I do a story that the last lake to be addressed was done this year?
No. What you might be thinking of is Loon Lake was the last lake in the Soldotna Creek drainage where pike were identified, and we got rid of them in Loon Lake last August. So that's a pretty big drainage. It's 42 square miles. It involved pike populations in 7 or 8 different lakes and ponds, and they were using the creek main stem as a corridor for movement. Occasionally pike would leave the whole drainage and enter the Kenai River, and that's what really spooked us. Our big fear is that pike will inhabit a real valuable salmon rearing habitat like the Moose River or Beaver Creek or the Swanson River drainage. And so this was the pike project involving, Soldotna Creek drainage was really a prevention project. We did not want to see pike expand in some of those real vulnerable areas. And so, yeah, we completed that 4-year treatment last year. But we still have a group of 8 lakes south of Soldotna where we know there's still pike. Unfortunately, they're closed lakes.
Oh, okay. That really sounded like a little panic in your voice there when you said that they might make their way into the Kenai and then go to the spawning grounds. I guess I never thought much about the spawning grounds for salmon coming into the Kenai River. But
it's more the rearing. Juvenile rearing grounds. When you think of spawning grounds, you think of fast flowing gravelly water. The rearing grounds, particularly for some species like rainbows, coho salmon, they tend to inhabit slower moving water. They like shoreline vegetation, a lot of woody debris, and it just so happens that's the same kind of pike habitat that pike do very well in. Pike are ambush predators. They make a living darting out of weeds, grabbing fish, going back to the weed beds. So when you have overlapping habitat requirements, pike habitat requirements with like certain species of salmonids, the salmonids tend to disappear over time.
The pike being, are they apex predators in that environment?
Yeah. When you look at the Kenai Peninsula, for thousands of years, we've had this... a lot of these shallow lake systems and drainages that have been great nurseries for trout and Dolly Varden and particularly coho salmon. And all of a sudden in the last few decades, we've got this apex predator that's very efficient. It's been shown they target juvenile salmonids. They're soft fin fish. They're a greasy cheeseburger to a northern pike. And as they deplete those easy, real rich, fat-rich fish, they tend to focus on other species like sticklebacks. And eventually, we've seen in a lot of areas, they'll eat out all the fish in a lake. And they're subsisting on cannibalizing each other and eating invertebrates and mice and frogs and ducklings and that sort of thing. So they're a generalist. They can eat a lot of different foods, but they prefer salmon-like fish when they're available.
Wait. So these pike are eating ducks and mice and what have you?
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's really common, but I mean, just last week I talked to a landowner in the Tote Road area south of Soldotna, and they had a couple guys fishing pike, caught a big pike. One had another pike in its stomach, and the other one had a duck. And, it's not uncommon to find unusual things in pike stomachs. They're pretty adaptable.
Wow. Now, I'm from Dillingham, mm-hmm. and up in the lakes near there are pike and that are, I'm assuming, resident pike.
Mm-hmm.
And, we used to fish for them in the reeds, and you'd do that. You'd jig for them just outside the reeds, and they come and hit your line, and it's a good fight, Why are they a problem here? Is it because they were never here before?
I am so glad you asked that. I get asked that by folks all the time. Like, why are you worried about pike when they're native north of and west of the Alaska Range? And you're right. They're not native here, so they change the ecology of lakes. But I often hear people say, well, how come they coexist with salmon in Bristol Bay so well? How come they're not a problem over there? And what I can tell you is, in fact, pike have greatly altered the fish assemblage throughout interior Alaska. If you go to many of the sloughs and tributaries of, say, the Yukon, where pike are present, and you might not find a lot of diversity of fish in a lot of those side sloughs. It's mostly pike. And there's other fish like whitefish that you'll find and some salmon, but it's a different looking fish assemblage than there would be if pike weren't there. And not that that's bad. And in Bristol Bay, that supports the greatest sockeye returns in the whole world. There's pike in a lot of those drainages. So why aren't those sockeyes disappearing? It's that habitat overlap I talked about. There's not a whole lot of shallow vegetated areas in those big sockeye rearing lakes, like in the Wood Tikchik area. And the pike might live in bays and some of the shallow vegetated bays, but most of those sockeyes rear in the deep open water lakes. So there's some habitat separation there. So those sockeyes, those millions and millions of sockeyes, aren't exposed to that pike predation except when they get into those shallow areas.
Of which there's not a lot in the ponds and lakes on the Kenai Peninsula. Yeah. There's not a lot of deep water in there.
Yeah, we probably aren't going to have a big pike problem in Skelak Lake. It's a deep glacial lake. It's cold. It doesn't have a lot of vegetation. And it's not good pike habitat. Could say the same thing about Kenai Lake or Tustamina Lake. There might be a few pike there, but it's probably not going to dramatically alter the sockeye population that might rear in those lakes, as opposed to up in the Susitna drainage, we've got some sockeye rearing lakes that are much shallower, and we're seeing a lot of sockeye disappear up there too.
Mm-hmm. Jack?
Yeah, Jay, what I was going to say is that's actually what Rob is describing is with pike is actually the same relationship that all three of these species have, the reed canary grass and the lodia and the pike, is that the issue there is that can they coexist with salmon? Absolutely. But are you going to have reduced salmon populations? Absolutely. And that's inherently what the problem is here, right? And specifically for all three of these species, kind of what Rob was kind of getting around to was that they're really impacting the non-glacial streams much more than the glacial streams. They tend to be warmer and they tend to be slower, right?
Oh, okay.
What we've seen here on the Kenai is when pike inhabited, say, Soldotna Creek drainage, almost all the lakes that were shallow that pike invaded, we lost every native species in that lake over time, in a pretty short time, a couple of decades. That even includes the native three-spine sticklebacks that could be found in the hundreds of thousands in a lake. They all disappeared. Stormy Lake, same story, had the biggest Arctic char on the Kenai Peninsula just a couple decades ago. And that's about when pike were first detected there. And over time, that char population just started going downhill. Same with the rainbows, same with the rearing coho salmon. And by the time we finally got rid of the pike there in 2012, we only could capture a couple dozen Arctic char left in that lake, and they were all basically too big to fit in a pike's mouth. And that's probably what saved them. There were still some long-nosed suckers and some sticklebacks, but the sport fishery for rainbows and Arctic char had completely collapsed in, you know, in about a 12-year period.
Wow.
And that's a story we see over and over again. I just came from Tyonek. Pike are traveling down the west side of Cook Inlet in salt water because they can tolerate brackish water. They're showing up occasionally in commercial set gill nets on the west side. Fortunately, we're not seeing that here. Hopefully, there's enough tidal influence and salinity gradient that serves as a buffer for us. But anyways, Tyonek now has a pike problem, and I just was doing some work in Three Mile Lake system there, and that used to have all five species of Pacific salmon there, and they're all gone in a pretty short time. And it's a pike fishery now, and most of the folk locals there are not too happy about it.
It's like these pike are zombies or something, or
they're just a very efficient animal.
All right.
And there's nothing evil about pike. Okay. They taste great, they're fun to catch, but if you have pike in an area, you got to accept they're going to impact your native fisheries in most instances.
So getting rid of them and then getting rid of these plant things that we're going to talk about here to protect our native fish species, and I guess ducks and voles as well, this sounds a little bit like predator control, like, you know, people sometimes do with bears and wolves to protect the moose around the state.
Yeah, ideally, it's more than control, it's eradication.
Right. How many? Do you have any idea how many individual pike that there have been, like at the peak?
No, we don't have good population estimates for northern pike. We've attempted to do that here in some lakes that where we netted for a long time. And those estimates, I wouldn't say, are very good, but right now we're doing exactly that in Tyonek. We're teaming up fish and game with the village of Tyonek, and they're conducting a mark recapture estimate in 3 Mile to be able to estimate the pike population in that drainage and give us a feel for what kind of densities of pike can exist in these lakes where the native species have been replaced and all of a sudden you have just pike there. So that we're going to have some of that information. But I can tell you, we've caught many thousands of pike on the Kenai Peninsula.
Wow. Any idea how many sport fish have been devoured and lost?
There's been some work done up in the Susitna drainage where folks from the USGS, working with Fish and Game and others, have estimated the potential consumption of salmonids. And in places like Alexander Creek, which has a collapsed king fishery, where pike are likely responsible for that. And it's pretty amazing. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you the numbers, but I can tell you in a fairly short period of time, they can consume enough salmon, juvenile salmon, to cause a localized extinction in places like Alexander Creek, which I think is like 35 miles long and connected to lakes.
Wow. How are we doing with them? Are we winning the war?
On the Kenai Peninsula, we're sort of lucky. Our geography is such that we're essentially an island, other than an 11-mile isthmus up near Portage. So, and I talked about we're not seeing pike crossing Cook Inlet very often, getting caught in set nets on this side. So we're starting off sort of protected geographically. So the pike that we have, if we can get rid of them, hopefully we won't have them reintroduced by natural mechanisms or any mechanism. And we have a lot of glacial systems here that aren't conducive to supporting large pike populations. So compared to north of Anchorage and the Susitna drainage, our pike problem wasn't as big. And we think we got a handle on it. we've knocked them out of 90% of the water mass on the Kenai, and we're down to 8 known lakes with pike that total probably less than 90 acres on the Kenai Peninsula. That's what we know about. You know, I suspect there's some waters where we haven't detected pike where they still exist. In fact, I've had people tell me that's the case, particularly individuals that don't want to see the pike go away. So we're kind of fighting that battle too, that not everybody thinks it's a good thing to get rid of the pike.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't believe that there's the ecological concern with pike being invasive species here that there is.
Because they like catching them, or they just don't believe in the ecology?
A lot of them are like me, grew up in the Midwest, like to fish pike, and they don't want to lose that fishery. What is attractive about pike is they tend to be easy to catch. They can reproduce easily, especially in lakes where there might be low oxygen and might not support other fish. So you can have a fishery where it might not support a trout fishery, for instance. So
they do, like you were saying before, they're not an evil fish. They have some value. You just don't want them in your lakes and ponds with your salmonids.
We have a decision to make. If we want northern pike on the Kenai Peninsula or other areas where they're not native, we have to accept the fact that our native fisheries are going to change.
Has anyone ever come forward and said, I brought some pike down here one day?
It's usually not that easy.
Have you ever found anybody who has?
We have suspects in the past that have been contacted, but there haven't been any charges filed.
Because it's illegal, I guess.
Highly legal. It's a Class A misdemeanor. It's a $10,000 fine, potentially. And that person could be liable for the restitution, what it would cost to get rid of those pike. And sometimes that's hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I was just going to ask, what does this project cost in the last 20 years, 15 years?
The Soldotna Creek project by itself was probably close to $500,000. Stormy Lake, $250,000. These are not cheap projects. Our primary tool is rotenone. It's a plant-based fish pesticide. It's not cheap. It's upwards of $100 a gallon. It's very effective. It's got some pretty neat things. It's a plant-based chemical. It doesn't enter the groundwater, those sorts of things. It can degrade naturally pretty easily with sunlight and warm temperatures. So it's a nice tool, but it's not cheap.
Wow. Anything else I should ask you about the pike? John, anything I should ask him? Jennifer, you have any questions about this pike situation?
Well, Rob can speak to this. You know, the thing about reed canary grass as an emergent, and it grows into, the flowing water, and Elodia, which is an aquatic submerged plant, what it does is it kind of interacts with pike in the sense that it's kind of choice habitat. It's creating a wonderful habitat for pike to hide in. So it's kind of like you have this interaction going on here with invasive species to make it really a kind of a bad situation for native fisheries.
I have a coworker that's done a lot of work up in Alexander Lake, and it looks like the Everglades. There's all this emergent vegetation. You can use an airboat to get around the lake and that sort of thing. And rarely do you see juvenile pike because they're so good at evading predators and hiding in the weeds. And Elodia was introduced to Alexander Lake not too many years ago. And surprisingly, one of the Elodia surveys that my coworker was on, they were seeing juvenile pike in the Elodia beds, which, although the pike had been present there for years, they weren't seeing them. But actually in the Elodia beds, they were seeing the pike. So clearly it's a suitable habitat for pike.
Man. Well, let's talk a little bit about these invasive plants and such. Which one do you want to start with? Tell me about your invasive plants there.
All right. Reed canary grass was introduced as both a forage crop as well as a stabilizing for soils. It's really good at stabilizing sediment. So it was purposefully planted about 30 to 40 years ago here in Alaska, and it still has some uses as far as soil stabilization and as far as a forage crop, and it's still utilized that way. But definitely it's the outreach and the amount of plantings is decreased. And so we've taken it out of our seed mixes for DOT, which is a huge step, as well as a lot of farmers that were cultivating it are no longer cultivating it.
Oh, wait, so this was a commercially available grass mix then?
It was, yes.
Oh, so you could buy it in what like a True Value bag of lawn seed?
Exactly right. I mean, you when you buy grass seed, you can see the proportion of different species within that seed, and it was listed in some of the seed that you could buy.
Wow. Okay. So tell me what's so evil about it compared to, you know, Kentucky bluegrass or sawgrass that you might see in those bags.
And although Reed canary grass is native to some parts of North America, we don't see it here in Alaska. So it was introduced into the South Central region. And what we see is that it changes stream flow. So it increases sedimentation. It changes the fluid dynamics of a stream. It also helps with, as far as reforestation, it doesn't allow for reforestation of that stream bed. And so that's what we're seeing is just the change of the hydrology.
Wait, so this grass grows just fine in the water too then?
Exactly right. Oh. Yeah. So it'll grow into flowing streams.
Wow, that's unfortunate.
It is.
is that anything like what's that stuff they have down in the south? Kudzu?
Well, maybe you're thinking of Phragmites.
Oh. Yeah, maybe. I keep turning off the wrong
map. Well, kudzu is what's down in the southeast, yeah. in the sense of covering forests. But, you know, when you're out on the East Coast, you're talking about Phragmites that's really growing densely out along the coasts and rivers.
Yeah.
Yeah, Phragmites is a really tall emergent plant or emergent grass, I guess.
Yeah, the issue here is, you know, in a lot of ways, it's kind of similar to, you know, our native Calamagrostis canadensis, right, that grows all over the peninsula. The difference is that the Calamagrostis, when it grows on the bank, it overhangs, which is a very nice thing because it provides cover for fish. But it doesn't actually grow into the stream bank in the same way that the reed canary grass is doing it. You know, and there's that, Jed, there's that horror story from, like, Nebraska, right, from the Platte River, where they've spent something like, I forget, it's some outrageous amount, like $1 billion to, you know, to dredge out the Platte River because it got so thick with reed canary grass that it was occluding all flow, practically.
Man. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, so we're seeing it as a potential injury for salmon blockages as far as it's going up and spawning and habitat.
Mm-hmm. So are you, what's being done about these things?
Well, there's been a couple of different trials on the Kenai Peninsula over the past 15 years. One was tarping. Tarping proved ineffective. Actually, reed canary grass grows so densely, it grows via rhizomes, and the rhizomes would grow into the tarp, and then that would be what was growing above the tarp. So we saw that. So, and then we also looked at mowing and we looked at herbicide. And so really the only effective treatment is herbicide use. And that's what we're at right now is that we have some point locations. We look and see there's different metrics of what gives an area a good candidacy for if we want to put herbicide down. And then we go from there.
Mm-hmm. Who's making those final decisions on the herbicide and where they can be used?
I work with the Forest Service right now, so last week I went out and I sprayed at Russian River Campground as well as along their Rabbit Run Road where there's a forest clearing cut right above Jerome Lake. And then, so it depends on who owns the property, I would say, more than anything. And then U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the Fisheries Office, is funding a project. They wanted to work with Beaver Creek landowners, so I'm helping with that.
Mm-hmm. I know in some places, and I don't know what they're spraying for, maybe mosquitoes or something, I don't know, fruit flies, but you know, you see signs like, you know, no spray in this area. Can you spray anywhere you want?
Like in regards to Beaver Creek, my initial concern was that is where the city of Kenai gets their water. You know, that was a concern for me, as well as just the type of infestation. But we investigated into it, we surveyed, and so looking at that, any herbicide application that if we do apply herbicide would be downstream from the point sources for the city of Kenai water, as well as I guess their wells are very deep, so they weren't as concerned, or they didn't have any concerns with the issue.
Mm-hmm. What's the chemical use? Is it Roundup?
Exactly right. Glyphosate is going to be effective.
Oh, man. What about our bumblebees? Well, let's not talk about the bumblebees. Oh, and John wants to talk about Mobile.
No, no, I do want to say something about the Roundup. You know, the version that you're using over water is Aquamaster, right?
Well, Roundup Custom, but it's the new Aquamaster. But it's right. We mix our own surfactant.
But you're using your own surfactant. See, right. One of the mistakes when you read all about, you know, how bad Roundup is in the agricultural side of business, is that they're using. The really bad part of Roundup is not the active ingredient glyphosate. The really bad part is the surfactant, which is what is sticking the glyphosate to the plant. And the difference here is when we spray over water, we add our own surfactant, which is a lot more benign than what comes in the Roundup product. So we've reduced the toxicity of the chemical considerably by the way we're using it.
And I will add that we don't actually spray over water. What we're going to do is if we do apply herbicide, it'll be with a glove methodology where you have a double layer of glove and you dip your hand into herbicide. And so you're actually spreading the herbicide on the plant directly. And so you don't have as much collateral damage. And there's the risk of getting it into the water system is minimal then.
Wow. Have you gone out and done much of that so far?
I have never done that, actually.
Oh. When's the first time you guys are going out?
It really depends on, as far as the cost share program with U.S. Fish and Wildlife, how it goes through, as far as that goes.
Oh, okay. John, any idea when this is going to happen?
No, that's a different side of Fish and Wildlife Service, the fisheries office, so I don't know really what they're tracking over there.
Ah. Now, what about your plants?
Well, Elodia is, the difference between this and reed canary grass is it's not an emergent. It's actually a submersed aquatic plant, right?
Is this the stuff a couple years ago there was a big thing and splashed across the front page of the Daily News about they found it in Lake Spinard on airplane floats?
Yeah, it was found in Lake Hood, exactly.
Hood, right, Hood.
Right. And it was originally found in 1982 in Eyak Lake. And at the time... You know, down in Cordova. And at the time it was found, I don't remember who was doing the, probably Forest Service, but I don't remember who was doing the actual survey, but it was just an aquatic plant survey. And they found one specimen of Elodia. They took it and they pressed it. And so there's now this herbarium specimen stored away. But at the time, nobody really recognized that it was something to be alarmed about. So it kind of just idled there. And it really wasn't until 2009, 2010 that it was found up in the Chena Slough, Chena River area, you know, up in Fairbanks. And at that time, when it was found, people recognized that this was a new aquatic invasive. And so the alarm went out. And then starting about then, people started finding it in other urban areas, including Anchorage and the Sand Lake area. Eventually we found it down here on the peninsula in 2012. And the irony of that is... Actually, it was Rob here who found it in 2005. In 2012 in September. And it was at the end of treating Stormy Lake. They were putting out rotenone to kill pike. And so you got all these fisheries biologists, and they looked down at the boat. This is how it was always described to me. They looked down at the boat launch at Stormy Lake, and there's this green plant floating there that nobody's ever seen before. And so the irony, of course, is that they're treating one invasive only to find this other invasive. And that was the beginning of, you know, detecting it on the Kenai.
Now, what does this invasive do? What is it? If left untreated, what would it do to our environment? How would it hurt us?
Well, there's several things. I mean, the big thing is that it doesn't seem to have any real obvious competitors and it really takes off and it grows. The biomass just goes incredibly abundant and to the point where a number of things can happen. One is it basically can use up all the oxygen in the water column so that your water body becomes anoxic, which of course makes it very difficult to be a fish if you need oxygen. In some places, and we've seen this on the Chena Slough, and we've seen this in some lakes already in Alaska, it gets so thick that boat traffic is impeded. And of course, in Alaska, the big deal here, and that's why Lake Hood, it was kind of a concern, is that it can actually impede float plane access. It could get that thick.
No kidding.
Yeah, so that's obviously a big deal. The one study I want to mention is part of the problem, and this is generally true in the invasive species world, is the people who are killing whatever invasive, they're often not doing the publications because they're too busy trying to kill something. And so what happens is when you actually look in the literature, there's a lot of this, a lot of documentation for invasives is kind of absent from the literature. And so that's what happened in with Elodea, is that Elodea has gradually spread to places like New Zealand and the UK and Scandinavia and I think even Japan. And wherever it's occurred, it's done terrible things to the lakes and fisheries there. But when you look in the literature, you can't really find that much information. So there was a guy up at UAA, a guy named Toby Shore. He now has his PhD, so it's Dr. Toby Shore. But he was, at the time, he was working on his dissertation. And his study was to look at the bioeconomic risks of Elodea being introduced to Alaska. And when he couldn't find this in the literature, what he ended up doing for his dissertation was to basically interview a whole bunch of experts in both invasive species management and in salmon populations. And out of that, he generated a model. And what he's shown is that if Elodea gets spread over available habitat in Alaska, he's estimating it'll cost, on average, $100 million a year in lost revenue to commercial sockeye fisheries. And it may be as high as $500 million a year. A year, not one-time lump, but a year if it actually ends up getting spread.
Wow. That,
kind of stunning.
Yeah.
So it, even though it's kind of expensive to get to it, it pales in comparison to what the consequences could be.
What's the treatment for Elodea?
So we use a chemical called fluoridone primarily, and fluoridone is kind of it's almost like a designer drug in the sense that it has very few non-target impacts. And the way it works is it basically affects the formation of carotene, which is a pigment used in the photosynthetic cycle. So it only affects green plants. That's a wonderful thing about it. It doesn't affect animals. And the way we make it selective, and obviously it affects all green plants, right? And so the way we keep it selective to Elodea, it just happens to be that Elodea has very low tolerance for fluoridone. So what we do is we keep it at extremely low levels, and I'm talking like 4 to 10 parts per billion with a B. And so we keep it at these very low levels and for an extended window. When I say extended window, I'm talking months. And by keeping that low, it has a little bit of a collateral effect on native plants, but it doesn't kill them. But it is lethal to Elodea, and that's basically how we've been doing it.
Huh. How many places have you been eradicating it at?
Well, we know it's occurred now on five different water bodies on the Kenai Peninsula. And starting in 2012 with Stormy Lake, and then later that fall it was found in Beck Lake, and then Daniels Lake, and then in 2013 it was found in Beck Lake. So three lakes in the Nikiski area, and then we basically treated those, and to the best of our knowledge, you know, we've eradicated them. We started treatments in 2014, and by the end of 2015 we thought we had gotten it, and we're still doing a lot of survey work to confirm that in fact they're gone. And then last year, and again, it was you, Rob, right? Rob's like this. He's like the messenger of whatever, of doom. You know, it literally last a week ago, I mean, a year ago, was it January, February?
February, I think.
February, yeah. He was setting up for a youth fishing derby in Sports Lake, and he drilled like 100, you know, augured in 100 holes that he was setting up for the weekend derby, and one of those holes happened to have Elodea. So he keeps finding it. And at any rate, in response to that, we jumped on that very quickly because, you know, it's there's at least four, if not five, float planes, residents that own float planes in that lake. So the opportunity to disperse it was high. And then in addition, there's also a public boat launch that's used a lot there. And so there were different opportunities to spread it. So we kind of jumped on that pretty quickly. And we actually think we've nailed it already.
Since February.
Yeah, we kind of jumped on it pretty quickly. We're going to do one more herbicide treatment this year, but we can't find it. And it's kind of amazing because when you look at photos that were in the Peninsula Clarion last spring, and then you look at it now, I mean, it was rafting up on the shore, and you literally couldn't walk through it. it was that thick. And now it's I can't find it. So
wow. I was going to ask you about getting rid of that stuff. How much is this project costing?
So this too is expensive. It's on the order of, depending on how much flow is going through the system, it can cost anywhere from $500 to almost $1,000 per surface acre. So, you know, a 500-acre lake could cost as much as $500,000 to treat. And one of the reasons why the costs have not been that high, though, here in Alaska, is that an interesting attribute to Elodia is that it's a dioecious plant, which means that there's two sexes. There's a male and female plant. And the way it was initially spread was through the commercial aquarium trade. And the way we think it got into Alaska initially is that, you know, it came up in aquariums, and then when little Johnny wants to let his goldfish go but can't quite bring himself to flush it down the toilet, right, he takes them out to the, you know, the nearest lake and dumps the aquarium, and along with that goes Elodia. That's how we think it initially got, you know, introduced into the system.
Is this the stuff that's polluting infesting the Mediterranean? Because that happened at this giant Oceanographic Institute on the coast of France, and they flushed out an aquarium, and then all of a sudden this invasive species was spotted in the Mediterranean, and they were like the ones in investigating it, right? Because, you know, who else? They're the Oceanographic Institute, and they send all their scientists, they go looking for it, and they trace it right back to their own office.
I don't know if that's the specific one. I'm not really familiar with that story. But, you know, it actually could be very likely because Elodia is commonly used by biology labs. It's a favorite plant to dissect. And, I mean, you can buy it online from Carolina Supplies, which is what, you know, biology teachers buy their products from.
You know, you mentioned earlier about one of the problems with them is that they grow so thick that they could... take oxygen away from fish, but don't plants release oxygen? I mean, or is the problem that there's just so much plants in there, there's no more water?
Well, that's kind of it, but in addition, what happens is you create such a biomass that you start getting decomposition, and that's starting to use up your oxygen. And in fact, that's how Elodia kind of... What Elodia likes when it gets introduced into a water body is it kind of likes the softer muck to get started, right? And that's how it gets started. And the way it reproduces asexually, so you don't need a seed. What you need is just simply a plant fragment. And when that plant fragment gets introduced, whether it's from an aquarium or a float plane, that fragment starts to replicate. And anyway, what was the question? I lost sight of where I was headed with that. Oh,
but, you know, actually, I want to ask about that. So you don't need a seed. You don't need a whole plant. You can just have a little bit of it stuck to your float plane float and then just fly off to another lake.
That's right. And actually, that was the rest of the story I was trying to tell you before, is that because there are two sexes, we think the way this might have occurred is across the state is nobody, to the best of my knowledge, nobody has seen flowers or seed production. In other words, by pure luck, we haven't had both sexes come together anywhere in the state. So nobody's none of the populations have yet to produce seeds. And I think that's the thing that's saving us here in the sense of treatment and why we've been so successful, because we have been knocking out these populations in about 2 years. And the reason why, you know, it hasn't persisted is because there's no seed bank. And that's one of the beauties of going after Elodia now. And it's why we're in my opinion, that's why I think we need to hurry. Because once we get males and female parts together, then we're going to end up in a very different story.
Wow. Do you guys have anything to ask or say about this Elodia business here? No?
I think it just underscores how the public can be involved. You know, the mantra of invasive species work is early detection, rapid response. John's talking about getting after Elodia fast before it can develop seeds. So that, you know, as far as engaging the public, they're the eyes and the ears that we have out there. We can't be everywhere. We have a lot of tools that we use to detect invasive species, but we can't beat the public giving us a call and saying, hey, I saw something that doesn't seem right. And that's just invaluable. I mean, just this week, I talked to a landowner, said, hey, I heard these guys dumped a bucket of fish in so-and-so lake. That's invaluable, you know. So having public engagement's a huge thing. And the public education thing like we're doing right now, I think a lot of people don't understand how dangerous it is to do something as simple as dump an aquarium. And it's the plants, it's the tropical fish diseases that we've had here on the Kenai from aquarium dumps, those sorts of unplanned, unexpected things that happen, and just bringing awareness to it to help us prevent. That's the key here, is we want to prevent invasives where we can and detect them early where they do exist and do something quickly to get rid of them. That's the best case scenario.
You know, I did another story about 20 years ago of an invasive critter. It was a crawdad that they found north of Kenai here somewhere. Are those still around?
No, I don't think so. There's been a couple of introductions of crawdads that look to be live crawdads used for like Louisiana boils, you know, feeds, and some were released alive. One was into a small creek near the Kenai Airport, and there were some raw crawfish released right into the main stem Kenai River years back. We did a lot of survey work. We never found any after those dumps. It doesn't look like they reproduce, but they have established themselves in Kodiak. The Buskin River
has yes, they
got
have.
A viable reproducing crayfish population.
I've eaten some of them.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I lived in Kodiak before I moved back here, and did several stories on them. They get about that big. I mean, they're tasty for evil little mud bugs.
So it's, I guess, yet to be seen how they may impact the fisheries there, but there's a lot of potential for them to dramatically change things. And I know where I grew up in the Midwest, some species of crayfish were introduced to lakes that ate vegetation, and the weed beds disappeared. So a lot of unintended consequences sometimes with these people releasing invasives.
Yeah, there are. I was going to ask about the... something that I completely forgot. Fortunately, I can edit this out. John, you look like you're about to say something. Let's go that way.
Well, no, I just wanted to underscore the whole business about, you know, citizen monitoring and the help we get. I've had a lot of calls and emails over the years now about suspected Allodia population. And I really appreciate it. The best thing I can get from somebody who thinks they have may have Allodia is for them to actually text me a photo. And it's invaluable because Allodia is pretty recognizable. When I say a photo, I mean talking about a photo of the plant in your hand, not in the water. If it's in your hand, I can pretty much tell right away what it is or what it isn't. And I can tell you that I have followed up on every single lead that I've gotten so far.
Wow. You know, I was going to ask or make a statement or maybe get your opinion about down in Kodiak. There's an invasive species called orange hawkweed, and it's a very nice little plant. The stems can get pretty long, but they're usually about this tall, about a foot tall. Beautiful orange flowers on them. They're like orange dandelions, basically. And they come up during the summer after the dandelions, and they're beautiful. And they were brought there on purpose as a yard plant. The guy who brought them there. Admitted he brought them there, you know, like 45 years ago, but they are everywhere now. They are all the way to the south end of the island. And, you know, they're not currently endangering the salmon or anything. And I think back of all the stories I've done about the dangers of orange hawkweed and how it's taking over Kodiak Island, and we've got to be prepared pales in comparison to talking about the dangers to our salmon here on the Kenai Peninsula. This actually, what we're talking about here today, actually sounds kind of like, I was going to say it sounds like an emergency, but it sounds like, you know, we're on the, over the hump of the emergency, maybe, or we should always be vigilant, perhaps.
Well,
do you guys think?
There's a difference in the three species here. I mean, in the case of pike, I mean, the goal here is to eradicate them from the Kenai Peninsula. In the case of Elodia, here too, we're trying to eradicate it from the Kenai Peninsula. But reed canarygrass is a very different situation in the sense that it's so contaminated some watersheds already that that's not happening. What we're trying to do, though, with reed canarygrass is we did this analysis a few years ago that we called the reed canarygrass strategic plan, and we documented 127 watersheds on the Kenai Peninsula. Of those, reed canarygrass only occurs in 30. So there we're switching our strategy. Rather than trying to control reed canarygrass in the 30 contaminated watersheds, we're trying to keep the other, whatever that is, 80 or so watersheds clean. So it's almost like a containment as opposed to an eradication. Very different approach.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that that you've tried before with other things or critters?
As far as knowing what's clean and trying to keep it clean and doing surveys?
Segregating and... were you saying?
Containment.
Containment. Have we tried containment with other things before? Does it work?
Well, I think typically we focus on eradication when we can, just to be mindful of what we're using herbicides for, or what we're using chemicals for. But yeah, as far as this, I mean, we really kind of narrowed out containment, control, and eradication and tried to be really thoughtful in our approach to it and what makes sense as far as our watersheds. And some watersheds lend themselves to one strategy versus another.
Well, and it has to do as well with the dispersal mechanism. So with reed canarygrass, the seeds are typically moved by, vehicles down roads. So that's typically how it's moved. And you mentioned like orange hawkweed. The reason why orange hawkweed couldn't have been stopped is because it's a wind dispersed plant, very much like dandelions. So basically, when it gets introduced to a system, if you don't jump on a wind dispersed plant immediately, you may as well go home. I mean, it's then or never, and we do look at dispersal mechanism.
If we back up and just look at the big picture on invasive species and how they fit into really the health of the planet. There's a lot of changes going on with the planet right now. Some of them are human-induced changes, and I won't get into that. But our extinction rate right now is equal to almost anything in the fossil record. And there's actually a name for it, the Anthropocene right now. Right. And the biggest two drivers of our loss of biodiversity, the bugs, the amphibians, the fish that have disappeared forever, is habitat loss, habitat change, and invasive species.
Really? Invasive species?
Yes. Displacing, outcompeting native species. So we're just a few pieces in a very big puzzle, and invasive species aren't going to disappear, but we're fighting the battle. And I'm hoping that down the road there's some new technologies that give us better tools to kind of bring balance to the fight, so to speak. There's always change. The planet's always changing. And not that that's bad or wrong, but invasive species are like some of our other big problems. It's the rate of change that invasive species can cause. It's the rate of change that... habitat loss can change, where we're not talking thousands of years for a new species to appear and adapt and evolve. We're talking years or decades for fish assemblages to disappear and that sort of thing, at least localized. So that's the big concern. We're changing really fast, and invasive species are a big driver of some of these changes that we're seeing.
Yeah. The only other piece I'd add on to that, Rob, is the, when we talk about something being exotic, it can also be invasive. And then the third piece, which we've kind of been talking about here, is injuriousness, and the fact that, some invasive plants are more injurious than others. And like in this case here, with these three species, they all were introduced initially for because they were being used for a useful purpose. Whether it was an aquarium plant, or somebody wanted a fish pike, or in the case of reed canarygrass as a forage or a erosion control plant, right? They all have positive properties. The problem is they all have these unintended consequences that we think are more injurious than any of the benefits could ever be. And so that's the piece that we're trading off here. And we think, you know, these are, you know, on the Kenai, salmon is everything, right? and so are trout and other fisheries. And the issue here is that these are just causing, they have the potential to just wreak havoc to our salmon fisheries. And so we think it's worth going after.
It might be worth defining what an invasive species is. You know, it's a non-native species that John mentioned, and it has the ability, the potential, or is causing ecological or economic damage. And often the traits that make up an invasive species are similar between different species. They often are opportunistic. They often have really high reproductive potentials. They're generalist. They often can live in a lot different type of habitats. And so they're very successful. That's what makes them a threat, either through predation or outcompeting or actually smothering out other species. They're highly successful species, and they're outside of the niche they developed in and can really run amok. And unfortunately, humans have been pretty good at promoting that.
Speaking of promoting, there are plenty of different ways that these things can be spread. We talked about the airplanes and the cars. In one of your emails to me, John, you mentioned felt-soled boots. What's the deal with those? Fishermen use those,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a better one for Rob to respond to.
Yeah, so just keep in mind that, especially when we're talking like aquatic invaders, things like New Zealand mud snails or quagga mussels, which are small mussels that are now invading Western U.S. They're not native to North America. Those kind of things, even some plants, they have life stages where they can exist in cyst, very small microscopic cyst form or egg form or fragments. Anytime you have something, a porous material like felt soles, they can absorb to that and get released in another water body, and that's been shown to be a real problem. In Alaska, felt soles were banned by the Board of Fish for anglers, so you can no longer wear felt soles, and it was prompted over concerns of things like Didymo. It's a algae, it's a diatomaceous algae that can form long stringy material and cover rock beds and streams and stuff. So in 2012, felt soles were banned for sport anglers, and turns out Didymo is native to parts of Alaska, some drainages, but you still don't want to move them from one drainage where it doesn't, you know, where they exist to one where it hasn't before. And same with all these other animals and plants that could hitch a ride. So the reason felt soles are banned is they're difficult to clean, as opposed to like rubber bottom wading boots that might have spikes. It's harder for them to adhere to that, so they clean a lot easier.
Right. You know, I was down in the Southwest last summer, and in areas where there's like fishing holes and, you know, near borders or something, there were turnoffs and signs, and, you know, I imagine it was their version of fish and game in whatever state I was in. But there were places where when you pull your boat out and you're heading off somewhere, you have to pull over and they inspect your boat and your gear and stuff for, mm-hmm. you know, whatever you may have pulled out of that water accidentally.
And we've had something similar here at Sport Lake where mm-hmm. we had boat inspections when Elodia came out. Clean, drain, dry. As far as aquatic hitchhikers, invasive species, that's the mantra. Clean, drain, drive. That goes for fishing equipment, boats, wading. That's the thing people can do if they're interested in preventing the spread of invasives, is to look for plant material, rinse yourself off at the water body that you're at, and air dry it. And if you're even, you know, if you really want to go the extra mile, some people will do a mild bleach solution cleaning of their waders and stuff afterwards, like a tablespoon of bleach and a gallon of water, and rinse off their waders. And that would just ensure that you're not going to transport invasives somewhere else later on.
Yeah, I'd add too, you know, last year in Sports Lake, there was a short period there where we had the boat launch closed down to public access. But during that time, we were using our boat to get in there and survey and treat. And even though we're very conscious of conscientious about inspecting our boat. You know, when we pulled our boat out, you know, we checked the prop and we looked around and we thought we had it clean. And we were just about ready to drive away and somebody had the wherewithal to actually look underneath. And sure enough, there was an Elodia piece hanging off the trailer right underneath the boat that we had all missed. So, I mean, that is the danger of it. I mean, you know, and we're consciously looking for it, but it, you can miss it.
Wow. Well, that is an hour on the tape. I don't know how much longer you folks want to go, but I think I'm out of questions unless you guys can think of something you'd like to add. Jen?
I would just say also with the clean drain dry is to check live wells, check your bilge pump, things like that. I think those are some pieces that people overlook, and then just be cognizant and aware of machinery. Machinery can spread invasives too, so it's a good idea to rinse off machinery too if you're doing some type of major lawn project.
Ah, good point. Robert, anything final?
Just am really thankful for the people in the community that have given us support, the ones that pick up the phone and call when they're worried about maybe a new critter they've seen or a plant they've seen. And I just encourage people to be the eyes and ears for us. I think people's mindsets have changed. I've seen it just in the last 10, 15 years that people do see what's at risk, what the potential loss could be if we don't do our best to contain these problems. And so I just really appreciate people having an open mind and a lot of the landowner and public help that I know Fish and Game has gotten in recent years. That's huge for us.
This really seems to be the kind of thing that people can get behind, isn't it?
Most people.
Yeah.
There's a few people that really push against it too, you know.
Can you introduce me to any of them? I'd love to interview somebody who's against controlling invasive species.
Boy, I mean, I've got some names. Just I'm not give sure them, they just, appreciate
Well,
the
just give them my phone number. Okay.
Well, I'd add to that what are the problems that we've encountered? You know, when people are understandably concerned about having chemicals used on their lake, you know, and but the message that I always have for folks like that is that it, you know, obviously I care about their particular lake. I don't, you know, I'm not interested in toxicological effects and unintended consequences. But the reality is for what we're talking about here, we're talking about 4,000 lakes on the Kenai Peninsula, right? It's not about a single lake. At the end of the day, it's about what's going to happen to the rest of the peninsula. And if this stuff gets out of control and goes in a different direction where we can't stop it, then we have put 4,000 lakes at risk.
Excellent. Well, thank you all for coming in. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You've been listening to the Kenai Conversation about invasive species with guests Jennifer Hester, Rob Massengill, and John Morton. For KDLL, I'm Jay Barrett.
Reminisce each Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. with Sal Cassano as she features the artists and their music of yesteryear. Learn fun facts about all your favorite dead musicians right here on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai, Soldotna.